All right, Friday news fans, this is the takeaway for January 19th, 2018.
It's the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being here on this Friday that's almost 1 year to the day of President Trump's inauguration. The government is now headed toward a possible shutdown at midnight tonight. House Republicans reached a deal last night between Freedom Caucus conservatives in leadership that let them overcome intra-party warfare, at least for now, and pass a bill to keep the government open for just another month.
The only people standing in the way of keeping the government open are Senate Democrats. Whether there is a government shutdown or not is now entirely up to them. I also want people to understand that Senate Democrats do not oppose anything that is in this bill. They're just holding this critical funding hostage for a deal on a completely unrelated immigration issue.
House Speaker Paul Ryan there putting pressure on Senate Democrats and taking some credit for a House that just managed the bare minimum of governance. We'll be talking about how shutdowns affect the military in just a minute. But in the Senate, a different story.
Our current CR expires 19 January. This is wasteful and destructive. We should not delay any further.
These talks have been going on endlessly. Many of you have not been involved in them. We're exhausted.
Kicks the can down the road.
Shoehorn that issue right into it.
The only person who's ever rooted for a shutdown, frankly, is our president, who said our country could use a good shutdown.
Why did they never let us reach an agreement? Illegal immigration.
Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell there. Chuck and Mitch and the recriminations of a Senate in a showdown. Mitch McConnell needs 60 votes to keep the government running for another month. Schumer and the Democrats have some leverage here, and they want a promised fix to the DACA program for young undocumented immigrants that President Trump is ending in March. Won't forget about 60 votes. Mitch McConnell doesn't even have 50 Republicans right now to keep the government open. Where's President Trump, the dealmaker, as Congress looks for direction and a presidential signature? He's scheduled to be in Florida this evening at his Mar-a-Lago Country Club. A $100,000 per plate fundraiser is on the menu there. Well, in a shutdown fight, and we've had a few of these in recent years of dysfunction, blame is the ugly little name of the game. A shutdown, you've heard, would be devastating to the troops.
Our men and women in uniform need our help. They need these resources so they can do their jobs and do it safely.
We have a military we have to fund.
The president certainly doesn't want a shutdown. And if one happens, I think you only have one place to look, and that's to the Democrats who are holding our military and our national security hostage.
We cannot shut down our military and put this nation at risk.
GOP voices there who are the ones arguing in this case that in the battle to fund the government, it's the military that pays the price. Well, how does the military function when the dysfunction in Washington grinds government to a halt? We asked Joe Gould. He's a Capitol Hill reporter for Defense News.
Troops who are considered contract employees are still going to show up. Overseas operations are going to continue. It is incredibly disruptive. I talked to lawmakers from Virginia and Maryland who represent the suburbs around Washington, D.C., contractors, civilians. There are tons of government civilians working in the Pentagon and elsewhere. It would be pretty disruptive for them. There's already work going on to make sure that they're paid retroactively. I don't think that that's a tough sell in Congress to make sure that troops are paid, to make sure that federal government civilians are paid over this period. You know, separate from the kind of day-to-day effect on the troops that a shutdown might have, I think there's kind of the larger argument on military spending, and I think that's what Republicans here are using as a cudgel against Democrats. So there are the immigration debate has kind of entangled federal spending for the defense and non-defense sides of the budget. Republicans have consistently over the last few years argued for raising defense spending. Democrats have insisted that the non-defense side of the budget be raised in equal part. That's a problem for Republicans because, you know, fiscal conservatives in their own party don't want to see domestic spending increased. But one thing that Republicans who are, you know, are somewhat fractured can all rally around is increased military spending. And the Pentagon says that it really needs it. There's been some struggles with troop readiness. You see the Pentagon and also lawmakers who are concerned about defense saying there are planes that don't fly, ships that don't sail, brigade combat teams that are not ready for combat. And then finally, you have a president who campaigned on rebuilding the military. Well, that's tough to do for a number of reasons, but I think that the Republicans, if they're going to do it, they're going to have to make the case. Mm. And I think that's some of what we were seeing this week from Capitol Hill Republicans.
So, Joe, one part of this whole spending debate that people like Defense Secretary James Mattis hate is the idea of the continuing resolution. They call it the CR. Basically, it's the spending patch. So how does this continual, you know, inability of Congress to get a year-long or a two-year-long spending deal and just go month to month to 3 months to 1 month affect Mattis's ability to plan for the military or run a ship over there?
Oh, they hate it. The Pentagon hates continuing resolutions. I mean, you could argue that for the past several years, Congress has not passed the budget on time. The fiscal year starts September 30th. We're nearly 4 months past that point. So we've used a series of patches to get here. I mean, if you could imagine what it would be like to work in any kind of business, any kind of corporation, if you had to plan several months at a time, you didn't know what was going to happen, you know, with your budget for the entire year, it would make life very difficult. Take that and apply it to the military, which is a gigantic organization. And the practically speaking, a continuing resolution keeps spending going at the previous year's level. So they can't start new acquisitions programs, for one thing. And they've said that it's incredibly disruptive.
Anybody trying to run a government agency hates a continuing resolution. Jim Mattis hates it. Francis Collins, director of the NIH, was on this show yesterday. He said he hates it, too.
Yeah, Jim Mattis, actually, the defense secretary, came to the Hill about a week or so ago and really said to lawmakers, you know, I understand that you want to deal with parity for non-defense spending, but what I can't stomach is the budget instability. It's complicating things. We've seen lawmakers who are pro-defense say that they cannot vote for the continuing resolution because of the damage that it inflicts on the military. The Armed Services Sea Power chairman in the House, Rob Whitman, Lindsey Graham is another one. They said we can't vote for a CR because of the instability. And they're saying, really, you know, if Congress buys another 30 days, what's going to be different? They don't want to vote for a CR unless leadership, Democratic and Republican leadership, can say, we have a deal in hand. In that case, they'll vote for a short CR just to give lawmakers time to, you know, flesh out what appropriations are going to be for the year.
Whether it's disruptive, whether it's devastating, might depend on what kind of debate you're trying to have on Capitol Hill as Congress barrels towards a shutdown. Joe Gould, Capitol Hill reporter for Defense News. Thanks for being here, Joe.
Thank you.
Hours after President Trump was sworn into office back in 2017, 1 year ago, the takeaway traveled to Oklahoma, Trump country, and sat down with one family of Republicans, the McConnells. They were a little bit divided over how they felt about the president-elect.
I think he's too bombastic. I think he goes overboard, but I think it appeals to a lot of people. And in some ways, it appeals to me.
That's Wayne McConnell. He's a plumbing contractor in Oklahoma City. Wayne didn't vote for Donald Trump or for anyone for president, but a year into Trump's term, we wanted to check in to see how Wayne feels now. And he says that he and the other McConnells of Oklahoma have been pleasantly surprised.
At this point, I am more optimistic overall with most of my family and friends. Everybody is more pleased than what they thought they might have been.
Now, tell me where your new optimism comes from, Wayne. There was a lot about Donald Trump you didn't know before. You've had a year to spend with him as president. So what has you feeling good?
Well, he hasn't backed down as much as some people thought that he might have. He's willing to confront, to some degree, both sides of the aisle to put forth his agenda. And we are heartened that he is taking on both sides more than what we thought he would.
You say that President Trump hasn't backed down. I'm trying to look at some of the major agenda items that have come through Washington. President Trump campaigned full stop, 100% Obamacare will be repealed. He didn't succeed at that.
But it wasn't that he backed down on it. It's that McConnell and the Congress could not pull the votes.
Well, let me ask you about the other big item that the president achieved, which was the giant tax cut. This was a heavily corporate kind of Wall Street style tax cut for the most part that sent most of the benefits to the top. There are some tax cuts for the middle class, but let's face it, not most of them. Wayne, did the nature and the sort of the look and feel of the tax cut match up for you for the kind of candidate that President Trump was?
Well, I don't accept your premise that it benefited the top and didn't do much for the middle. That being said, I would much rather see the deficit go down than give everybody more money at the expense of the deficit. I'm not convinced that it was the right way to go, but I'm not against it either.
How are you feeling about the Russia investigation and where that's headed?
Well, I'm one of the conservatives that thinks it's a lot of hot air. I think it's a bit of a witch hunt. The things that the United States has done through the CIA to influence other countries' elections make whatever they think Russia has done to the United States, buying ad space on Facebook, seems minuscule in comparison. Nevertheless, I don't hold that there's much out there for Russian involvement through Trump or anybody else influencing the election.
Four people around President Trump so far charged with felonies by Robert Mueller, a Republican, by the way, Robert Mueller. That aspect doesn't put a little meat on the bone for you and at least make you wonder if something substantial isn't at play here?
No. When you look at what's been thrown against Hillary Clinton with Benghazi, when you look at what Bill Clinton went through with Whitewater, with Mena, Arkansas, with the uranium deal, with the Indian businessman, with a thousand different things, when he got indicted, when he got impeached, all kinds of stuff has been thrown at Bill Clinton, and he still stood upright. And if they've got four felony counts against four of Trump's associates, no, I don't put much stock in trumped up charges either.
What about the president's behavior in public? How do you feel about that now?
Well, I wish he wasn't so antagonistic. Part of it is just his bravado, and the left, so to speak, wants to play that up and use it against him. And I wish he wasn't so antagonistic. What he said, or what I'm assuming he said about the other countries, has a kernel of, let's say, logic to it. Now, it may not be politically correct, but if I go to hire someone into my company, I look at their background, I look at what they bring, and will they be an asset from a strictly business point of view? He makes a point, uses that kind of rhetoric, and I may not agree with it or I may agree with it, but if he weren't so bombastic and antagonistic, it wouldn't make the news so much, and he, I think, wouldn't be so in turmoil so much.
Wayne, when you visited with us a year ago, one of the issues that came up was race and ethnicity. How did you view, for instance, the protests in Charlottesville? That's something that's happened over the last year. We're talking about the president of the United States, and isn't it the president's responsibility in a situation where on one side there are white nationalists and white supremacists, and on the other side there are people protesting them, to give an unambiguous and clear message about which side this country is on?
He did that several times, actually. I happened to be listening to Rush Limbaugh one day, and he read verbatim what it was. I happened to be on a news site, and I read myself a press statement of what he had said. I think that he got a raw deal and was misrepresented, and I think that it was misconstrued sometimes. I think he's too antagonistic, and I wish he would shut his mouth. I wish he would stop his Twitter. But I think that the press is much more adversarial with him than they ever were with a Democrat president, and that's just my opinion.
There's an idea among a lot of people that President Trump has sort of this 35% floor. He never goes below it, no matter whether he's caught in a lie or caught in a scandal or something like that, and that a lot of people are devoted to Trump no matter what. Do you find that in some of the people you talk to?
I think a lot of that is you find Trump as an alternative, not Trump specifically to him specifically. He has separated himself from the establishment left and the establishment right, And I think a lot of them see him as a viable alternative to the two that they don't care for.
So, Wayne, you said last year and you pointed out today that you didn't vote for President Trump. You kind of withheld your vote for president because you didn't like any of the choices. You're feeling a little bit better now, and I won't ask you how you'll vote in 2020 because it's a little early for that. But I think there's a pretty good chance that Donald Trump could draw a primary challenger from his own Republican Party. If that were to happen and the president were primaried, how would you feel about it?
I would vote for whoever I thought would make the best president. I didn't vote for Trump because I didn't want him to be president. He was an unproven factor to me. I knew his background and I knew what he had said on the campaign trail. I didn't trust him. He didn't have a background that I trusted. And so even though I agreed with a lot of what he said, I didn't trust him and I wouldn't vote for him. At this point, now that I know what he's done for the last year, if he were in the primary, and if someone that I liked better was running against him and I wanted that person to be president, well, then I'd vote for that person. I'm not a stalwart supporter of him. I'll vote for the person that I think is the best candidate given my moral and political views when that time comes.
Wayne McConnell is a plumber from Wellston, Oklahoma, a Takeaway listener, and a second-time guest on this show. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
There are a lot of ways to slice the first year of the Trump presidency. And the polling, not so optimistic. The NBC Wall Street Journal poll out today, 1 year in, 39% of Americans approve of President Trump's first year, 57% disapprove. It's the lowest one-year approval rating for any modern president. And dig down in the numbers. Pollsters asked what word best describes how voters feel about President Trump. The most common, 38%, disgusted. What about you? Have you felt a change in your life since President Trump took office? How have Trump administration policies affected you?
This is Kate. I'm calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. My son has been threatened with racist violence because of Trump, with Trump actually mentioned. So we haven't been affected by his policies so much as his white supremacist views and the way he upholds the white supremacist culture.
Hey, this is Dan from Portland, Oregon. First of all, I'm a Trump skeptic, but I haven't really seen that his policies have had that much of an adverse reaction. The tax plan is actually going to give me a big, pretty good boost, looking at about $30,000 being able to deduct from my taxable income. We're a family of five that between the two of us make less than $70,000 a year. So, you know, for a working class perspective, it's actually going to benefit me and my family tax-wise.
Bonnie Brenner, I live in New York State. President Trump's change in the real estate tax in New York has changed my life. My husband and I are seriously considering moving out of the state to make up for our loss in deductions on our tax return.
James Mitchell, Slidell, Texas. The tax cuts that they've enacted will eventually cause me to pay more taxes, and they have not gotten the CHIP program funded, which affects my grandson because that's what he's on. We're going to have to spend some money to help the whole country get out of the mess we're in.
This is Beth from Manchester, Missouri. So far, it hasn't happened, but if my nanny cannot renew her DACA status, my kids won't have a nanny, and my son is autistic, so it will be very difficult to replace her.
This is The Takeaway.
There's no time to explain.
There's no time to explain. Come on.
Dude, there's no time to explain.
There's no time to explain this.
You know, I really don't have time to explain.
There's no time to explain.
No time to explain.
There's no time to explain.
There's no time to explain now.
There's no time to explain.
No time to explain.
I can explain.
I can explain.
I can't explain.
I can explain.
I can explain.
We get about 4 minutes for the movie segment every Friday with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, which is plenty of time for him to explain usually the best movies for you to see on the weekend. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Great to have you. We got two movies coming up. I have a little bit of trivia for you, a little bit of movie history
okay.
for you. You're usually pretty strong in this category. Here's your trivia question. Hold on to the answer. And listeners, if you know it, hit me on Twitter. If you know the answer, we're going to answer at the end. What Pixar hit, Rafer, began production on this very day, January 19th, 25 years ago, 1993. What Pixar hit began production today, 25 years ago? Think about it. Get back to me. My Forever My Girl is your first film, Rafer. Bethany Ashton Wolf is the director, right?
That's right.
A bit of a love story. A music superstar reunites with his first love and realizes the steep price he's paid for fame.
I mean, is it okay if we go guitar shopping tomorrow after school? You should come with us until you're comfortable with me and Billy spending time together, obviously.
So you, me, and Billy?
Yeah.
So that's Liam Page there as the character, country music superstar, who 8 years ago had just left his bride standing at the altar, went off, had a great career, found fame and fortune, but has come back. And now he thinks he wants to have her back. And the little girl that we heard there is his daughter, who his bride-to-be, I suppose, has raised. When I was watching this, I was thinking to myself, this is a great movie if you're a guy. I mean, everything has really gone swimmingly well for this guy. I mean, he got to go off and, you know, have his fill of groupies and drugs and parties. 8 years later, he comes back. Here's his girlfriend just waiting for him right where he left her. And
realistic.
She's got a daughter. And he hasn't had to change a single diaper. The daughter's 8 years old and she's really cute. And so I was thinking, gosh, this is great. And what's fascinating is that this was directed by a woman and written by a woman. So I just feel like, you know, it's a win-win. It's a win-win for everybody. It's great. We all get what we want in this film.
You sound infuriated by the entire
premise. I'm being that's what you're hearing is a little bit of sarcasm. To be honest, I found this to be a very, very creepy film and probably the most dysfunctional romance since 50 Shades of Grey. That's my actual reaction.
Well, I need to bring myself down a little bit for your next film, Rafer, because we have to get to it. Chris Hemsworth of Thor fame goes to Afghanistan in 12 Strong.
We're teaming up with a warlord that we know nothing about. We're not going to be able to tell our enemies from our allies. Every step we take is going to be on a minefield from 100 different wars. And no one's ever called in a smart bomb airstrike from a B-52. So anyone who tells you they've done this before, has experience in this, is lying, sir. There's no playbook here. We're going to have to write it ourselves.
How does it stack up as a war film?
As a war film, I think it's pretty solid. It's entertaining, interesting story, true story. Basically, the first Army soldiers to go over into Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks. I didn't feel it played up that quite as much. I would have been a little more interested in sort of the novelty, the foreignness of this experience. But as a war film, it's pretty solid. I feel like it's not exactly looking at the larger picture of the war in Afghanistan, but that's not really what the movie's here for.
Well, people love Chris Hemsworth, and that may be enough for a lot of people. Let's get back to trivia. Rafer, I have a phone a friend, a little bit of a lifeline for you. Your old movie date partner in studio here, Kristen Meinzer, is on hand.
Hooray! Hey, guys, how are you?
Guys, let's get to trivia real quick. I asked you what Pixar hit began production 25 years ago today. Rafer, Kristen?
I'm going to guess that it's Toy Story.
We don't like being blown up, Sid.
Yes!
Or smashed, or ripped apart.
We?
That's right, your toys.
Kristen Meinzer comes back with the right answer. Kristen Meinzer, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks, Rafer.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks, Kristen.
Thanks.
Kristen Meinzer is here for a very different kind of movie now. There's a new BBC documentary coming out all about the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II on June 2nd, 1953. Seems pretty standard fare for the old BBC, except this one has what no other documentary or TV show has ever had, an interview with Her Majesty herself. Apparently, it took 22 years for the BBC to nail down this interview. The Queen, she's a tough get. She's the toughest get. She's never sat for an interview before. BBC's royal commentator Alistair Bruce sat down with the 91-year-old monarch to talk about the crown jewels, including the everyday crown, you know, the one that everyone needs, the one that you can really get dirty.
You have to keep your head very still.
Yes, and you can't look down to read the speech. You have to take the speech up. Because if you did, your neck would break, it would fall off. So there are some disadvantages to crowns, but otherwise they're quite important things.
Kristen Meinzer, of course, is director of nonfiction programming at Panoply, co-host of When Meghan Met Harry, a royal wedding cast. Kristen,
yes.
Welcome.
Hi.
Queen Elizabeth has never given an interview. The BBC is even technically calling it a conversation to appease the palace. It's not an interview. It kind of makes it remarkable, though, that she agreed to it.
Yeah, I mean, she has had a few conversations before, but as far as like a really big deep dive where it's about herself and... This is a huge deal because no monarch has ever talked about the coronation. This is a very sacred thing. It's like a combination of a baptism and a wedding and a million other things all in one giant ceremony. No monarch has ever talked about coronation.
So why now? Why did Queenie do this now?
These are her glory days. These are her final days. You know, she's getting up there in years, and she's going out on a high note. People love her. The crown is hugely popular. Her grandsons, her two eldest grandsons, are possibly the two biggest rock stars in the whole world right now. And Harry, of course, with his wife-to-be Meghan from America. She's got international appeal. This is a very special moment in her life, and people are loving who she is right now, and she's letting a little bit of her human side come out.
And interest in the royals is soaring. I mean, I, like many people, feel like I've already seen the coronation because I watched The Crown, and they went into it in such detail.
Yeah, but funny, she says she has never seen this footage.
Right, never seen the footage that she watches with the BBC in this.
Yeah.
But people love this show. Claire Foy as Queen Elizabeth II is amazing. Matt Smith is amazing. The real queen doesn't have to do an interview like this, and yet she thought that this was the time.
Yeah, and I'm so glad she did, because we're learning little tiny bits and pieces about her as a human, not just as a monarch. We learn the stuff that they keep from her. For example, during World War II, all the crown jewels were disassembled and hidden. Normally, they live in the Tower of London. They're always guarded by yeomen. They're always completely, like, behind many layers of glass and so on. But she didn't even know what they did with the crown jewels during World War II. And we find out in this documentary, they tell her, we found out they were disassembled, put in cookie tins, and then hidden in the basement of Windsor Castle. So we get all these fun clues like that. But we also get to hear her say very cute things. Like, for example, when she picks up the crown, she says, this thing weighs a ton. And then when she's looking at the pearls, she says, how sad are they just hanging there? Pearls are alive and they need to be kept warm. Mm. So we get little tidbits of her human side, and it's very sweet.
A 91-year-old queen granting a little bit of an audience. Kristen, look, we're Americans. We have no time for kings or queens. In fact, we went through a lot of trouble to get rid of these people in the first place. Why are we so interested in them? Because really we are. I count myself right along with them.
Yeah, I like to think that they're the longest running reality show in human history. It's a 1,200-year-old family drama. People marrying their cousins, beheading people, having affairs, doing all sorts of nefarious things. And it's always an exciting thing to watch. And they just are never going to go anywhere. So it's so fun to see what unfolds next. And especially right now at this peak moment, where Meghan, one of our own, an American, she's going to be marrying into the firm, and she looks more like the rest of the world. You know, this family is very white, very, you know, they have a certain look. They are very British, and even though they're German also, and now we have somebody who is an American who's half black. She's like us, even though she's a famous celebrity. And it's just a very exciting time for this family.
The coronation is on the BBC, but Queen Elizabeth, Her Majesty herself, Queen Elizabeth II, is helping out for this one, helping us. Kristen Meinzer, what a pleasure to have you back.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Kristen Meinzer is host of When Meghan Met Harry, a royal wedding cast. Thanks, Kristen.
Thanks. God save the Queen.
Is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Thanks for being with us this hour on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. On Thursday, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced a new office in their Civil Rights Division. The Conscious and Religious Freedom Division is tasked with handling complaints from healthcare workers who object to procedures on religious or moral grounds. Here's HHS Office for Civil Rights Director Roger Severino.
And we are institutionalizing a change in the culture of government, beginning with HHS, to never forget that religious freedom is a primary freedom, that it is a civil right that deserves complete enforcement and respect.
Well, there are already conscience protection laws in place. This latest announcement elevates concerns beyond contraceptive rights and abortion, though, to potential discrimination based on sexual orientation or other factors. At least that's what critics say. In other words, policy under this new office could mean medical professionals can turn away people who they don't want to treat for transgender issues, for example. That's got advocates really worried. We turn now to Holly Fernandez-Lynch, an attorney and bioethicist. She's assistant professor of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philadelphia. Professor, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what is this new Conscience and Religious Freedom Division at HHS? What are they and what's their job?
What this is a division that's joining two others in the Office of Civil Rights at HHS. One of those offices focuses on protecting healthcare privacy under the HIPAA law. The other was already established to protect and enforce federal civil rights laws. And religious freedom is a civil right. So one question that a lot of people have been asking is why pull out the protection of religious freedom out of the existing office that was tasked with protecting civil rights? And so the pre-existing office focused on discrimination against patients. And also there was an arm that was focused on enforcing existing federal conscience protections. So they will accept complaints from healthcare professionals who allege discrimination on the basis of their religious beliefs. And they'll also go a step further to conduct active compliance reviews, audits, and other enforcement activities.
So it sounds like this office is designed to elevate the issue of conscience objections, ostensibly from conservative or religious healthcare workers who don't want to participate in some form of healthcare because they object to it. They're not enforcing any new rules. So what is the existing standard under federal law for conscience objections of this kind?
Sure. So right now, they're not enforcing any new laws or new regulations, but it has been reported that there is a proposed regulation working its way through the White House that I have not yet seen. And the reports that I've seen about it, I don't even know that the reporter has yet seen. So it's a little bit sketchy what the details are. But what's been reported is that there would be heightened protection of religious freedom and conscience for healthcare workers and further enforcement authorities. But the existing standard are several federal conscience clauses that are already on the books. The longest standing is a set of protections that's referred to as the Church Amendments, and these have been around since the 1970s, since the Roe v. Wade decision. And what this is a set of very robust protections for healthcare workers, not just physicians or nurses, but anybody in a healthcare setting. And it protects them against employment discrimination for refusing to provide or assist with abortion or sterilization procedures. An interesting thing about the Church Amendment is that it protects both refusals to provide those services, but it also protects people who are willing to provide those services against employment discrimination.
So a lot of this seems to center around abortion, reproductive procedures, as you mentioned. And we've seen in recent history, doctors, nurses, others who've objected to performing or participating in abortions. I guess that's not entirely new. But with this office up and running now, Professor, who else could this impact? Could a person with religious convictions refuse to treat a transgender person or a drug user or a sex worker? How far could this go?
So the answer to that question is yes. And that's one of the things that's most concerning about what this office is proposing to do. The emphasis here is on the religious freedom and protection of conscience of these healthcare workers. And we know that some healthcare workers express objections to treating transgender patients, to treating people who live lifestyles that they disagree with on a religious basis.
Let's talk about how these types of conscience objections can work in the real world. If you're a pharmacist, let's say, who doesn't want to dispense contraceptives, and there are 20 other like you within a mile, then probably not much is lost. Somebody can go around the corner to the next pharmacist. But if you're the only pharmacist within 50 miles, then it seems like there's a far different ethical consideration behind an objection like this.
I think that's absolutely right. And so I am a strong proponent of trying to accommodate conscience whenever it can be accommodated. And what I mean by that is making sure that patients have access to the services that they need in a non-discriminatory way. So there are some types of conscientious objections that I don't believe are discriminatory per se, right? You might say, I don't provide this service that I find objectionable to anybody who asks for it. I don't provide the birth control pill to women. I don't provide vasectomies to men. You know, it's against my religion to limit the number of children one might have. And if a patient is able to get those services in a reasonable geographic area, still covered by their insurance, without having to make a whole bunch of other appointments and take time off from work, those are the sorts of accommodations that I think can be appropriate. And we see in the pharmacy context, you know, if I'm a pharmacist who objects to birth control, but the person who's standing directly next to me is willing to fill that prescription, the patient may not even need to see that that religious objection. They may not be affected by it at all. However, as you mentioned, you know, if you're the last pharmacist in town or you're the last physician who is able in a reasonable geographic area to provide that service, then what needs to come first is patient access. And I will say that yesterday at this press conference, there was hardly any mention of patient interests at all. The only thing that was discussed was occasionally patients will have needs for modesty and who they're seeing in the doctor's office based on their religious beliefs. But there was not discussion about the fact that when we have healthcare workers who are refusing to provide services, that has a real impact on patients who are then unable to achieve those services.
Professor Holly Fernandez-Lynch, thanks for being here.
Thanks again for having me.
Holly Fernandez-Lynch is Assistant Professor of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine.
We've been fighting for 45 years about abortion's legality, and yet I didn't really understand at all what happened when abortion was banned.
Michelle Oberman is a professor of law at Santa Clara University, and she set out to try and answer that question. What actually happens to women and to society when abortion is banned? She started in Chile in 2008 because Chile had one of the strictest abortion bans in the world, and what she found surprised her.
From the very get-go, from the very first interviews that I had with doctors there, I learned that abortion is commonplace in Chile, that in fact, any day, any person who has a smartphone and a little bit of money can buy abortion medication on the streets.
And enforcement of the ban? Not so much. Only 5 or 6 cases ever got prosecuted every year before the ban was eased slightly in 2017, mostly in Chile. Law enforcement tends to look the other way. Well, travel north to El Salvador, where abortion is completely banned, but still commonplace by every measure, and things look different.
The country actually sent prosecutors into hospitals around the country starting in 1998 when they first passed the ban in order to urge doctors to report patients whom they suspected.
The number of prosecutions is still very low, about 10 per year, according to Michelle Oberman. But she says we can learn a lot by looking at these women's stories and considering what it can actually mean for women and society when abortion is legally banned. It's the topic of her latest book, Her Body, Our Laws, on the front lines of the abortion war from El Salvador to Oklahoma.
The interesting pattern, or perhaps troubling pattern in El Salvador, is when it happens and where it happens. The best study of the enforcement of the abortion ban in El Salvador took a 10-year period from 2001 to 2011 and investigated all 149 reports of abortions that took place during those years, and found that every single one of the reported cases came from public hospitals. Not a single private paying patient was ever reported to the police.
That seems to suggest that that's where poor women are going for care, because wealthier women, if they want an abortion or have side effects from one, can afford a private hospital where they won't be reported.
Absolutely. And they can also afford to have a doctor who will maintain their confidentiality. One of the consistent themes I found in my interviews with doctors throughout El Salvador, public and private hospital, is this idea that medical confidentiality has become a commodity. And just to be clear, let me talk about what goes wrong for these poor women with illegal abortions. They're much more likely to take the wrong drugs at the wrong time, too late in pregnancy. They're more likely to have severe hemorrhaging. And because of that, they're more likely to end up in the hospital. And it's not really just women. It's girls in particular. And you could see why it would be the case that a teenage girl might be more at risk. She's just got less education, less resources, less mobility. And so they really are the population that is showing up at the hospitals with these severe complications from the medical abortions. That said, the women who are getting reported are actually not necessarily women who've taken drugs trying to end a pregnancy. Instead, around half the women who are reported, and even a higher percentage of the women who are convicted, are women who have late-term obstetrical emergencies. They're showing up to the hospital having gone into labor and delivered babies outside of the hospital setting, usually in very rural areas. So outside of the hospital, in outhouses or at home, having actually, in many cases, wanted a pregnancy, not wanted to have an abortion at all. They show up at the hospital, the doctors want to know where the baby is, and immediately move into crime scene mode rather than into healthcare mode.
How does what you learned in Latin America inform what might happen here if Roe v. Wade were overturned, if abortion were banned in this country?
So we can predict, I think, with absolute certainty that abortion won't go away. And we can predict that because, first of all, it's likely to remain legal, banning some sort of amendment that bans it throughout the country, which I think most experts think is unlikely, then it's likely to remain legal in a number of states throughout the country so that women with means will travel. And let's be really clear about it. Life has changed here since 1973. Women are different. Access to travel is different. Access to information is different. Money is different. Abortion technology is different. And so travel, which we already see in states that have, for example, tightened up access so that they have fewer clinics, we already see a lot of abortion travel where women will, from Texas, just say, as we saw in the wake of the whole women's health cases, the clinics became farther apart. You had women going to New Mexico. I think it's inevitable that abortion will remain commonplace in this country. Abortion medication is going to be a problem. We don't really need to look any farther than our battle with prescription painkillers to understand what access to abortion medication is going to look like. We'll see a lot of side effects from medication taken, perhaps adulterated at the wrong dose, too late in pregnancy. So those women will show up in hospitals bleeding. I think we're going to see a real push for medical confidentiality because I think doctors across the board understand that it's a really bad idea to put a tax on coming to the emergency room. In other words, if women fear being reported, they won't come get the health care that we need to give them in order to save their lives. And in many cases that we need in order to treat obstetrical emergencies in order to save the lives of their babies. I mean, the tragic part about it is that I think both sides would agree that the best way to lower abortion rates is to deal with what's causing women to want to abort in the first place. And actually, I learned that most profoundly in my time in Oklahoma, working with pro-life people who are trying to persuade women to keep their babies. I mean, you can't deal with abortion simply by making it illegal. It won't go away. You need to change the material circumstances of women who have abortions because they feel like that's the only choice they have.
One of the premises of your book, Michelle, is to blow up some of the myths, or at least the vague beliefs that Americans have on both sides of this debate, or at least that the warriors of the abortion debate have. The idea that abortions will stop if abortion is illegal, or that women will die if abortion isn't legal. And you've really overturned some of those beliefs, I dare say, on both sides. You've already established that abortion won't go away if it's illegal, because there's proof of that from Latin America, but also that even a legal abortion, frankly, is much safer than it was in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, it's a lot safer. I want to be clear here. Women will die. It's not a joke. Legality matters. And we can already predict which women will die. I mean, hundreds of teenagers die every year in El Salvador, either from illegal abortion or they commit suicide. I mean, the rate of suicide among pregnant teens in El Salvador is so high that 3 out of every 8 maternal deaths involves a pregnant teenager killing herself. So it's not like it's a joke. My point, though, is that the abortion tribalism that we're living in, where our focus on legality is really the be-all and end-all, is astonishingly naive. We need to start asking ourselves what we think will happen if abortion is illegal. And both sides need to be having that conversation because it matters. I mean, it's naive to take a political election and have it turn on who announces that they're going to make abortion illegal without asking, and then what? We need to be having a conversation that moves beyond the simple legal or illegal focus that we've been blinkered by over the past 45 years. It's not going to go away, and our job is actually to find ways to support the poor women who are going to struggle. They're already struggling.
Michelle Oberman is professor of law at Santa Clara University and author of the book Her Body, Our Laws on the Frontiers of the Abortion War from El Salvador to Oklahoma. Professor Oberman, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, next week, we look at the legacy of Roe versus Wade 45 years later, and we want to hear from you. Do you believe women should have the right to an abortion? Have you ever had an experience that helped inform your view? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to hear where you fall on this issue. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.